Hey everyone, this is co-host Andy here. Thanks so much for tuning into Roll for Topic. I wanted to give you a little bit of advance warning that this episode, the audio quality is a little bit lower than our normal standards. Between me being sick with my voice really kind of giving out on me and a few technical difficulties, the audio is a little choppier than usual. That said, I think it's super listenable, and I hope you'll go on to listen to it because we have a fantastic guest in this episode talking about some really good stuff. Thanks so much, and here's the episode.
I got a six.
John, the discussion we'll be having today is about the topic, how do you prep for a role-playing game when you have no time to prep?
This is a good topic for me.
That is. That's a very good topic for you, based on what I know about your GMing style. So, at any rate, hello and welcome to Roll for Topic, a roundtable discussion about topics related to running role-playing games. My name is Andy Rao. I'm normally joined by my co-host Chris, but he is absent today. I last saw him, we were chatting online, and I heard some sirens in the distance, and he abruptly announced that he had to go. So I assume he's on the run, he's on the lam.
He hasn't contacted me, if anyone's wondering. I know nothing.
So I'm joined today by John Corey from our sister show, The Splat Book. John is one of my favorites, if not my absolute favorite GM in the world. And John, I'm really grateful you've agreed to join and fill in for Chris today. So
I'm super excited. Folks may remember, oh my gosh, it's almost 4 years ago now, that which means you've been doing this podcast a long time, Andy. But when Chris's son was born, he needed a sub for a few months. And that's how Andy and I got to know each other, was subbing on this podcast. So I'm super happy to be back.
That's right. So we've come full circle after 4 years. That's a terrifying thought.
It is.
I should also note, for astute listeners, have probably noticed that, yes, I have a cold. I don't know how long my voice will last here. When I mentioned to my wife earlier today that I had podcast recording, she just started laughing. So so we'll see how my voice goes. But in the meantime, I like to think I sound more like Batman than Bane. But let me know if the opposite is true, and I'll try and,
I've noticed when I have a cold, I sound like George Takei. Like, my voice gets really low when I...
Hey, that's a good thing, actually.
Yes.
All right, so hey, John, before we dive into our topic, Chris and I usually banter about a little bit, and I thought I would start with a little update on something I've been reading that's role-playing adjacent, then I'm going to toss the same question over to you.
Awesome.
I picked up a little while ago, kind of on a whim, a book by Stu Horvath, who I believe is a figure. He does some podcasting or article writing in the RPG space. I wasn't real familiar with him, but the book I picked up from him is called Monsters, Aliens, and Holes in the Ground, and it is basically a tour of his role-playing game collection from in chronological order. The photos in the book, I think, are mostly or all photos of the actual books from his collection. So you have a couple of cool photos where you can see the names scrawled on books by previous owners and that sort
That's pretty cool.
Lovely little artifact. I want to talk about this book because I am pretty familiar with the history of role-playing games in a broad sense. I'm no expert, but you know, I can tell you about the different versions of early D&D and when Traveler came on and what that meant. And this book takes a little bit of a different take just in limiting its discussion to what's in my collection, the author's collection.
Right.
Now, because the author's collection is huge and comprehensive, it actually is not that different from like just a tour of major RPGs through the years.
Right.
However, there is that added element of curation that is like, to me, that's like two-thirds of the hook here. And he does little write-ups on each game. And, you know, they are maybe mostly write-ups on, like, why is this game historically significant?
Mm-hmm.
But you do get some paragraphs for each along the lines of, you know, like, how he encountered it and what it meant for his gaming. And I'm just so charmed by that approach. And it just got me thinking, I don't know, what do you think about that, John? Like, let me hear your thoughts.
I think that's amazing. And actually, I feel like we're living in a golden age of early D&D histories and sort of histories of the hobby in general. My selection, which I will not reveal right now, is similar. It's a history of D&D particularly, or history of role-playing games. But there's that. There's Game Wizards. There's a lot of stuff coming out about how, You know, we just had Evan Torner on our podcast, who wrote an article on the history of combat in D&D specifically.
Ooh.
So I think it's really interesting as somebody who's been playing this hobby for a long time. The one thing I struggle with all of this is I started playing D&D probably in 1980. So this was the time of AD&D and the first hardcovers, the Player's Handbook, Dungeon Master's Guide. And so now all of those things are history. And it is hard to have those things be history when you remember playing them when they were new.
Yeah.
But it does charm me because I have my experience. And, you know, I think the more you learn in life, the more you realize your experience is not, it has some universal elements, but there's a lot of rich depth in hearing other similar but not identical experiences to learn more about the things you're interested in.
Yeah, I will say, I don't want to get too cheesy here, but, you know, one thing it took me too long in my life to understand that for me, it is more valuable to hear how a piece of art or a piece of entertainment affects you, the viewer, and interacts with your interests and your artistic interests and your maybe gaming interests and your personal interests. That's more interesting to me than this sort of very commonplace approach we all take to media, which is trying to kind of rate it on a scale of goodness or quality, right?
Right.
And I don't know if people have always done that, but I feel that today everybody imagines that they're, you know, a New York Times critic.
Yes.
Making an evaluation of the latest Batman movie, making a historical evaluation of its quality in the history of all art. I mean, that's fun, I guess, but it's so much more interesting for me to read an essay about what it was like for you personally to watch, whatever, the latest Batman movie, and why you hated it or you loved it or it didn't do anything for you.
Yes.
Than it is to try to read someone trying to place Batman alongside Citizen Kane and the works of Plato and, you know.
Yeah, I agree completely. And I think what's important there is shared experience, right? Like if somebody has a shared experience and you have an experience with that thing and then they bring a new insight to it and you say, wow, I've never thought of that. So then you both get the universal experience. We shared an experience which draws you to the work. And then you get and I got to learn something, get an insight about another person, which is always exciting, I think.
One last thing I want to mention about Horvath's book, which I do recommend that you check out. He obviously had an interest in the works of the Judges Guild,
which was interesting.
An early third-party producer. Very early, they were on, you know, in the years after D&D was on the scene, I think, Judges Guild appeared, and they released a lot of material. And he highlights some of the most famous ones. Some of the, I think, the best regarded were written by Janelle Jacques, who passed away recently. And so he talks about, like, Tegel Manor and Dark Tower, one or two others. But I think they published, like, 100 to 200. I mean, I think their volume of publication was very high. And so that is like a hole in my picture of that early hobby. That if there's like dozens of Judges Guild things out there, that makes me really curious to find out what I'm missing.
It is interesting because if you look at the roster of like official AD&D adventures, the official adventures, there's, you know, at a certain point, you know, there's the Giants and the Descent into the Depths of the Earth. And eventually there's a million of them. But in the early 80s, when there's hundreds of Judges Guild things, there's probably just a couple dozen official adventures, which means there's way more Judges Guild material than official material. There are actually two for my beloved Dragon Quest. There were two Judges Guild adventures, which I think I still own them. I might have gotten rid of them, but yeah, so they're a place in the hobby that I think influenced a lot of people, but in small ways. You know, everybody has their Tomb of Horrors story, but does everybody have their Mage Bird quest story? Probably not, but they still had a huge influence on the hobby.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, well, check that out. That's Monsters, Aliens, and Holes in the Ground by Stu Horvath. And John, have you been reading or watching or listening to anything that's got your GM brain going lately?
Yeah, I have. I've been listening to, or I've been reading, actually, a physical book. I do a lot of audiobooks these days, but the thing I read most recently was, or I'm in the middle of, is The Elusive Shift, which was recommended to me by a listener of my podcast. It is a book by John Peterson. I think it's put out by MIT Press. And what it is a detailed history of the hobby on how did the form of play of D&D become what it is now. And the contents of the book is fascinating. I was talking to a friend of the show, Matt Wilson, this morning, and I was describing it to him, and I said, it's the kind of history book that I really love because he goes into such exhaustive research detail on the early communications in the hobby that I would never do myself, and then summarizes it for me. So he is picking up dozens of different fanzines from the time, from people you have maybe heard of a little bit or never heard of, and saying in this fanzine issue number 17, so-and-so said this about how his group plays D&D. And we're starting to notice a trend in all these fanzines that the play of the game goes this way. And the other thing he'll do is take old early RPGs that nobody remembers anymore, like Space Patrol or Chivalry and Sorcery, and say, in the intro text to Chivalry and Sorcery, it says this. Or in Space Patrol, the example of play says this. So what he's trying to construct is, how do we get from the original intention of D&D, which was created by wargamers, and how did it fuse with sort of the science fiction and fantasy community to become different kinds of games? And what I learned, Andy, and I learned this about Andy, and I have this running conversation going on the side, which we will not bore our audience with, about Robert Caro's biography of Lyndon Johnson. But what I learned from The Elusive Shift and from that Lyndon Johnson book is things were not that different, in history. 40 years ago, 50 years ago, when this hobby started now, one of the quotes I highlighted was somebody saying, yeah, I was playing D&D and I got into this game and I just lost sense of time and myself, and I was so immersed in my character. And then somebody brought in some mechanical thing and it just burst the whole bubble for me, right? And I'm like, oh, that guy is me 50 years ago. Or there was somebody else who was saying, oh, if you're not playing correctly, if you're not strategically playing as smart as you can, and instead going with sort of a more narrative flow, you're not playing the game correctly. So there's this strategist story gamer, dynamic already when the game first comes out, which I thought was something new, and it really isn't. So,
wow, that's fascinating.
Yeah.
Yeah, there is this tendency to think that branch between kind of the simulationist approach to gaming and the more narrative branch happened like in the late 90s or something. But I agree with you from, just personal anecdotal evidence that tension has been there since the beginning of the hobby. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's just fascinating to watch the author put together those things, the amount of research and detail. I can't imagine doing that myself. So I'm always sort of just like, impressed that he managed to put the thing together at all. And his coherent argument is it's the merger of wargamers and story people like fantasy and science fiction fans that create the hobby that we know today. It wasn't the intention of Gary and Dave at the beginning, but other influences made that happen. And the other thing that's interesting is into a lot of detail about the different regions of the country and how they played. Unsurprisingly, Los Angeles's D&D scene was a lot more loosey-goosey and story-based than the East Coast's D&D scene or the Midwest's. So he gets into some of that too, which is interesting as well.
So I know nothing about regional RPG differences, and that sounds so fascinating. So again, is his main source of info is like his zines, which would be more local?
It's like a write-up of a game from a group in LA that was published in a fanzine, and then he contrasts it with a write-up of a group in Kansas City that had a much more stringent, strategic, formal approach to it, and then compares and contrasts the write-ups of those two campaign write-ups and describes the differences.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah, it is amazing. I recommend it. It's called The Elusive Shift by John Peterson, and I can't recommend it enough, actually. I read a similar book about sword and sorcery, I think I talked about, not on your podcast, but maybe with Kyle on mine, called Flame and Crimson, which is a similar sort of thing for sword and sorcery, where somebody just digs through all these old fanzines and reads the dialogue in there and establishes a history of the genre. It's a very similar kind of thing.
Well, that dovetails with something I have gleaned from Horvath's book and from some of my other reading, which is it is always a little surprising to me how much of like the history of even big games like Dungeons and Dragons is a reactive history to what people are actually doing out in the world with it.
Yes.
So in talking about the different Judges Guild stuff, Horvath is pointing out, this is actually the first what we call a mega dungeon. And this is the first, whatever, you know, narrative story, really story-based dungeon adventure. And so TSR would then maybe come out with maybe what we consider to be a definitive version of a mega dungeon. But it was not an idea that they came up with. It was something that entered the hobby through the actual play and the publications of just everyday people, which is fascinating to me.
Yeah, and I think that's what the Elusive Shift is about. How did different people get here? Like, one of my favorite adventures, I think one thing I'd probably learn from that book is one of my favorite early adventures is, it's from the UK, it's U1, The Sinister Secret of Saltmarsh. And the reason I like it is it's like a Scooby-Doo mystery, and it's the first adventure I read that's like, oh, we're not just running around and chasing monsters. There's a story here. There are monsters to fight, but that's not the point of this adventure. And that really like broke my brain in a way that the Tomb of Horrors did not. And I'm sure that's not the first time somebody wrote a story like that, but it's the first time I encountered it because it's the first official one.
Well, that's awesome. So, hey, John, in the interests of preserving my voice before it gives out, yes, Let's move on to our topic. Just as a reminder, the topic we're discussing is, how do you prep for a game when you have no time to prep for a game? Like, listeners, we are talking to, I am talking to a very experienced, low prep GM. Would you say that is an accurate description of you, John?
Yes, I've tried to learn to be good at low prep GMing because I had discovered that I'm bad at high prep GMing, and I find high prep GMing very frustrating. Part of the reason I am the way that I am, and it's not that I don't run games that require prep, but my prep is different, and the prep on low prep games is just a different sort of prep. So I'll say a couple things about that. I've told this story before, but one of the reasons I don't like high prep is there's two. One is it can railroad a story, right? So if you prepare a lot of material, let's say you're really into miniatures, which is fine, but you build a big set or diorama or play piece and the players are like, you know what, I don't think we need to go there. You know, like, you can, as a GM, find reasons to make them go there, which defeats player agency. So that's reason one. Hmm. Reason two is I'm just not very good at it. I remember the moment my sort of epiphany was I made a big math problem for my party, and I was like, this is gonna be great. I did research on the internet, and I spent all this time, and I forgot my friend Steve is a math genius, and it took him, he just knew the answer. He was like, boom, that's it. I'm like, no, you don't understand. I spent all this time on this door riddle, and you're through it now. Like, it was really frustrating for me, and I realized I am not the kind of person who can challenge players who enjoy that sort of thing through doing more prep.
Interesting. My experience is, for most of my gaming history, I've tried to be a high prep GM, and that's still kind of what I aim at, but almost invariably, I will put a lot of time into prep that does not really give me the feeling of being all that well prepared for the game. And so even games that I have on paper prepped a lot for, I often wind up kind of, it's only in like the hour before the game starts that I really, I don't know if panic sets in or something, but I really am able to nail down the small number of pieces that really need to go into the game, if that makes sense.
It does. And I have a theory about why that happens, which is prep is not to prepare a story for your players to engage with, though that happens when you prep. Prep is to build confidence for you as a GM that you have a place to start and something to do.
Hmm.
So here's an example that I will give. So I love to do a low prep game called a Mad Lib. And this is not my idea. I found this idea originally on a site called RPG Alchemy, which is not around anymore. But I do want to give credit to that site creator. But what you would do is you would create a sentence, the sort of generic fantasy sentence. Like, we are a party that are going somewhere to do something to stop some evil. And that thing is guarded by some other great evil, right? And that sounds pretty generic, but what I discovered is most, not all, but a lot of stories in RPGs, what people are looking for is not the generic, but a very genre-specific example. So you can have a lot of fun. Let's take science fiction. Let's do space opera, right? You can have a lot of fun breaking tropes and genres in a sci-fi story, but I think when people come to a table for a game, they are hoping that the genre elements match the genre you're in, right? So if that's the case, then you as a GM already know, if you've seen a bunch of space operas, you already know everything you need to know about how that story is supposed to go. So you create, you want to have a villain, you want to have a challenge, you want to have, you know, some sort of difficult thing that they've got to do. So what I used to do, for example, is I would create this Mad Lib, and we knew they would have to fight some guardians of whatever thing they were going to. And I would create generic creatures that were just like low-level minion, you know, sort of brute and boss. And then when the improv started and they said it was a dragon instead of a purple worm, I would just maybe change the special ability of the boss a little bit so that it matched what they wanted to do a little more. And then I just lean into all of the genre fiction I've consumed over time to throw stuff in there. Like, for example, I used to do this Mad Lib in a fantasy game, and over, I would fall back on this plot, this novel by Carl Edward Wagner called Bloodstone, about a mad scientist who's trying to rebuild the evil temple in the middle of the swamp, and the heroes have to go in and stop him. Like, I just plucked that plot right out of there, put them in the swamp, and the game's ready to go. You know what I mean? Like, it doesn't have to be super carefully plotted. Does that make sense?
It makes total sense, yeah. For me, I have much less experience with this, and I often feel like I am stumbling into my low-prep games.
Right.
But the ones that tend to go best are the ones where I have nailed down with confidence, not necessarily with lots of text or info, but with confidence who all the players are and what they are trying to do.
Right.
And I find that it's a lot easier to whip up a scene if you know what everybody involved is trying to get out of the adventure, if that makes sense.
It does. What agendas and motivations do your NPCs have? So if you have no time, so there's two different things here, right? One is you're just running a one-shot from scratch. That's my Mad Lib idea, right? I want to run a fantasy one-shot. I'm going to pull together all these fantasy tropes that I know about, just lean on them, and we'll have a good time. This game has gone great sometimes. It's gone kind of mediocre sometimes, but usually it's an engaging game. The other game is I'm running a regular campaign, and I have to run it tonight, but I've been working overtime all week. What am I going to do? And that's the other sort of low-prep scenario. And I think that gets to more what you're talking about, which is what I have done is write down all of the NPCs involved, like on an index card, and just a one or two word, like, this is what they want. They're trying to get the bomb, the other person's trying to detonate the bomb, and the party's trying to stop that from happening, right? Because then you have tension, motivations, and you know what everybody wants. And then the sort of minion brute boss thing fits in. Like, in your game system, do you have a good idea of, from either a combat or just a social interaction standpoint, what are the key stats somebody would have? So if it's combat, right, for minions, you just need to know their hit points, right? For the boss, you need to know his motivation and some of his key spells, and then you can just bring that person to life. I think the biggest way you can waste your time is, what if you build a fully fleshed character sheet for your boss and he gets killed in 30 seconds? Like, you've wasted your time. So I'm just a big fan of, you, if you understand the basics of what's going on, you know, do you have confidence? Because it doesn't have to be great literature. I think that's the other big thing.
Yeah, so there's a topic that is kind of maybe a neighboring topic to this one, and I'm curious how you think it intersects. Does calling on the players to fill in details,
is that essential?
Is that a part of improv or low prep gaming, or is that something different entirely?
Nope, that's absolutely essential, because you can say, let's say you're running a Star Wars game, okay? And one of the characters is playing a Jedi. And you say, okay, and you know, like, you know a couple of things. It's a Star Wars game, you know it's around the time of the Rebellion, and you know one of the characters is a Jedi. You know that going in, so even if you don't have time to prep, you have some information. So you can say to that player, hey, how did you survive Order 66? And they say, oh, I was hidden by a family on this obscure planet, and I want to keep their information secret, otherwise the Empire will hunt them down. Well, you know, it almost feels mean, but that's how you get player motivation and action. You know, like the first thing that can happen to that player is, oh, you get a broken, disjointed message from that family. Something's going on, but you don't know what it is. What do you want to do? Oh, I want to rush to that planet. You know, so So it's essential to get player input like that, because if the players are just looking at you like, I don't have anything and I want you to entertain me, A, it doesn't really feel like an RPG to me, but B, low prep requires player input. I would say that's essential.
Is low prep just always going to be easier with mechanically simpler systems, do you think?
Yes.
I think of D&D as maybe a mid-level complexity game. You know, if I'm running Numenera where NPC stats are a single number between 1 and 10.
Right.
And then just some flavor to describe some special abilities maybe. You know, that's trivial to like whip up an encounter on the fly based on where the story is going.
Right.
But with D&D, if you have to pause and check the monster manual, I think if you're an experienced GM, you know, you're pretty good at like, well, I'll just use the goblin stats here and
exactly.
You know, and adjust them slightly based on what I need to happen. I don't know. Can you talk a little bit about the relationship between like the complexity of a system and how you do improv with it?
Yeah, I think there's two things that are important there. One is the complexity. So simpler systems. So I've done this with, this works really well with Powered by the Apocalypse games, which require a lot of player input anyway to even go, right? Some game where you're requiring bonds or interrelationships between the players to be defined by them. So simplicity is definitely important. However, I've also done this with like, I tried to do it with basic D&D, which doesn't have any mechanics to generate backstory or interactions, and it fell kind of flat, but it is a simple system. So I think there's two parts to it. One is, what is your familiarity with the system? And then what is the complexity of the system? Because there's probably a GM out there, and I would like to meet them, that could do this with the hero system because they know the system backwards and forwards. I'm not that person. But if it's a system I'm very comfortable with, I'm very comfortable doing it. But if it's super complex or super high level, so for example, I don't think this works with 15th to 20th level Pathfinder or 5th edition characters because the details of how you construct a boss to survive all of the overwhelming abilities of the 15th level paladin is so complex that you can't make that up on the fly.
Yeah, and you'd be trying to improv at that level unless you're extremely experienced with the system would, you know, be cheating everyone at the table of a cool encounter, right?
Yes, right? Like a good, like I've played in a 15th level 5e game and it was a blast because the GM had taken time to create encounters that were specifically designed to counter all the superpowers I had as a 15th level paladin, which is great. And that would be a hard game to improv. So I think it has to be simpler or your GM has to know it backwards and forwards.
I have watched both of my kids get interested in being dungeon masters. I have a teenager that has run a number of games and kind of understands how it goes. And I have a younger son, a middle school age son, who is more of a beginner. But both of them have tried their hands at GMing.
Right.
And both of them have, in both cases, I have like, you know, they've said, Dad, can we give me a good adventure to run? And so I've pulled something off of my shelf and I handed him, I gave my teenager Sinister Secret of Saltmarsh, for example. And,
right.
And it was interesting, but a little frustrating. Both of them had a hard time getting ready to run a game by just reading through the module.
Mm-hmm.
And it just made me think like how much of my prep is stuff I've figured out that I didn't learn from reading the Dungeon Master's Guide or the module, if that makes sense.
Like it makes total sense.
So do you think, can you do low prep GMing as a fresh new GM? Is that like a skill you can learn?
I think it's a muscle you have to build. And I think one of the things like any actor who does improv will tell you, it seems like what they're coming up with is new, but to them inside their own head, they've done it dozens of times. You know, improv, part of improv is learning different tools and techniques to improvising. And part of it is just experience. So the reason I'm able to do it is because I've been doing it for so long, but it's not that you can't learn it, but you would have to start, I think, by learning techniques that do that. Like for example, I would say, okay, come up with, if I were to teach a new GM who's never GM'd before, I would say, write down the plot and you're doing a fantasy game, write down the plots. You have three favorite fantasy novels, three NPCs from those novels, and then fill out index cards with three different levels of encounter, okay?
Hmm.
And have all that on index cards so it becomes interchangeable. But the first time you do it, and this happened to me the first time I tried to do it, it was bad. You know, like, so it took me I had to fall on my face a couple of times, which is no fun for anybody, especially if you're if you fall on your face and your friends are like, I don't want to play anymore. Right. So it, so I did it. Yeah. I did it with conventions. I'm like, come to my convention game, pay your $2. And when this game's a disaster, I'll never see you again. So that was kind of how I did it.
You know, if nothing else, you can be that story that people take home and they'll be like, you won't believe this terrible game I was in.
I know I've run at least two of those at my local convention. So yes.
Oh, that's lovely. Okay. Well, you know what? This has been a good discussion, but my voice again is starting to go. So I think we should go ahead and wrap it up. What's a piece of advice you would give to GMs that are trying to move from the high prep to low prep? Like what is a piece of encouragement you can give them or a thing to think about?
Here's the biggest piece of advice, and I know exactly what it is because it's what I struggled with. Don't feel like the story you're creating or improving has to be completely original and of your own creation. Let your players help you create it and lean on all the genre work that you've read and consumed throughout your life, and you'll create a fun game for your players.
You know what? So you've mentioned that once or twice, and it really resonates with me. A couple of weeks ago at the Ann Arbor District Library thing, Chris and I and our friend Phil were on a panel discussion, and someone asked, like, how do you keep your games, like, original or something, especially if you're running in an established franchise, and the example we were talking about was Alien. And I remember, I forget who answered the question, but I remember thinking, you know, people don't want an original Alien story. They want Alien, right? Yep. We all know what it means. And, you know, even there, some franchises like Star Wars or Star Trek, they're big enough that maybe you need to probably establish which version of that setting you're doing. But once you've done that, everyone knows what you want to experience, right? And so you're probably going to hurt your game if you try and get too original with it, unless everyone at the table is really looking for like an out there experience.
Yes. And what I'll say, like, for example, I ran a big Star Wars campaign that lasted a couple of years, and I started it. You're a video game player. I started it with the plot of the second Jedi Knight video game, where there were these characters called the Reborn, which are dark force users who didn't learn to use the force. They were infused. The force got infused to them through some experiment. That's how I started my game. And we went and did other stuff there, but I just lifted that plot. The plot started with them finding a crate of lightsabers that were intended for these Reborn, and the Reborn coming to get them back from them. And then I stole the plot from that video game, and we went and did our own thing. But it's okay to start with something that everyone's familiar with. In fact, it's better.
I have so much nostalgia for that game, by the way, John. You and I are kindred spirits in that regard. One of the first really good Call of Cthulhu games I ran, I didn't even file the serial numbers off the plot and characters and setting of a video game called Clive Barker's Undying.
I've heard of it, but I've never played it.
It's an obscure little gem, but I just ran that video game for them. It went really well. In that case, no one else had played the game, so it probably seemed like I had this remarkably complex setting. But, you know, even more, if you love something in the genre, or you've played an obscure game that others haven't, just milk that.
There's a difference between running a game with your friends and trying to publish something, right? If you're writing your own published adventure, do not steal the plot from Jedi Knight 2. If you're running a game for your friends, steal the plot from Jedi Knight 2. That's my advice.
I love it. Okay, John. Well, thanks very much for joining me. Again, this has been John Corey. You can listen to John and his podcasting co-host Kyle on their podcast, The Splat Book. John, what have you guys been talking about lately on The Splat Book? Just to tease some interest here.
Yeah, the last two episodes were an actual play we did. Kyle and his friend JP Kuvert, who are both YouTubers, wrote a Morkborg hack called Starborg. And we ran an actual play with you as one of the players.
It was delightful.
We had a great time. The second episode just came out. And then in 2 weeks or in a week and a half, I guess, Kyle and I just did a mailbag episode. Because it turns out actual plays are exhausting. So we're just answering some listener email and voicemail in our next episode.
All right. Well, awesome. Okay. And well, without further ado, then, I think we'll wrap up. Thanks, everyone.
Yeah, and remember, if your players are having fun, you're probably denying your own needs as a GM. No, that's not the tagline.
No, that's our new tagline. Thanks, John. All right. And also remember, if your players are having fun, you're a great GM. But okay.
All right.
Farewell, everyone.